On that basis, then we'll proceed with oral argument, and you do have up until close of business Friday to file anything you wish concerning the reference in the opinion to matters that are sealed.
Thank you.
Good morning, may I please the court, counsel? My name is Rick Ruffner. I'm counsel on behalf of the appellant Leonard Sack. I was not counsel below, but am counsel on appeal. I apologize to the court for my voice as I get started. The Colorado cold has caught up with me. We're here today on essentially a procedural issue, and that is whether the court's desire to orderly and expeditiously administer justice should outweigh a litigant's right to a day in court. As we've set forth in our brief in this case, Leonard Sack was denied his day in court essentially because of a procedural decision based upon the discretion of the judge not to allow him additional time to answer to a summary judgment pleading because he didn't have counsel and could not get counsel given the looming trial date. It is our position that substance, that is a day in court on the facts of the case, should clearly outweigh any expeditious administration of justice concern that the trial court might have had, especially when the trial court does not articulate any real reasons other than we're too close to trial to grant any continuance or extension. There was absolutely no substantive reason, no punitive reason, no sanctions reason whatsoever for the trial court to deny the request for additional time, other than the court felt we've got a trial date set coming up in 3.5 months. That is what trumps every other consideration in this case. And we urge the court to consider the procedural nature of this case and give a pro se, and the court should say that a pro se litigant faced with a dilemma like this in a very complex factual case should be given all leeway possible in order to obtain counsel so that he can respond to a complex summary judgment motion without simply denying his request for additional time, without any balancing of any of the factors and concerns. Appellee was correct. There's no Colorado case per se talking about the balancing of these interests and the factors the court must consider. But as we cited, the TEM case and the Bolton case, both of which are not civil, but nevertheless talk about continuance of trial compared to the substantive rights of a litigant, talk about the court's requirement to balance all of the competing interests. Here, based upon the record before this court, from the trial court, there's absolutely no indication that that balancing test was considered whatsoever by the court. And that in and of itself should be grounds for remanding this to the trial court simply to find out its reasons why a continuance was not granted rather than a decision that ultimately resulted in dismissal of the case.
Mr. Ruffner, didn't the trial court also take into consideration the amount of time remaining before trial after the August 29th, 2008 letter was delivered?
Well, he did. There was at that time 6.5 months, 7 months before trial. However, the whole purpose of that counsel's entry into the case was to contest the withdrawal. There was substantial litigation, obviously, over the withdrawal. That wasn't ultimately decided until November 21st.
Well, it was apparent, was it not, from reading the letter that at least by that time, by August 29, 2008, there was, in fact, a real conflict that would have made continued representation difficult, if not impossible.
I would certainly say it indicates that there's a conflict, but not a conflict that could necessarily result in disqualification of counsel. Otherwise, it wouldn't have continued to be litigated. Mr. Sack, through his counsel, continued to contest the withdrawal. He had no reason to do that if, in fact, he should consider his August 29th letter as one tantamount to agreeing to the withdrawal. He did not do that. So you have to look at what he did do. He continued to contest the matter. The court finally orally ruled November 21st and entered its written order January 6th. certainly from November 21st on, the time should be considered. How much time is it going to take to get medical malpractice counsel on his behalf in the case? That's what he was attempting to do. All of his motions that were filed in the January-February timeframe, as well as his post-trial motion that he filed, all were indicative of those efforts that he was taking to find counsel to replace the now withdrawn plaintiff's counsel he had before.
Well, let's, and I'm not asking you to concede anything, but let's just assume for purposes of my question that we agree the trial court properly denied Mr. Sack's motion for more time to file to find an attorney. Is there a separately appealable issue in the courts then granting summary judgment because there was no opposition, or is the real issue whether Sack should have been given more time to find a lawyer?
They're intertwined. I mean, the decision that's appealed is whether the summary judgment should have been entered because he wasn't given sufficient time, and should a pro se litigant be required to respond to that type of summary judgment motion, a complex summary judgment motion in this type of case. So it's not the denial of the continuance directly, but the denial of the continuance of the trial, in effect, impacted his ability to get counsel. And that's what he was saying. That's what he said, I can't get counsel. You're forcing me to respond. And as long as you have that April trial date, no attorney's going to come in and be facing that deadline.
Thank you.
We are asking the court simply to balance whether the expeditious administration of justice should overturn a litigant's right to a day in court. That's simply what's going on here. We're looking at a person who was pro se, an uneducated man who's pro se, trying to get new counsel on board once the court allows his former counsel to be dismissed from the case and to withdraw, versus should the court hold steadfast to an April trial date when there's absolutely nothing in the record to indicate why that April trial date was so sacrosanct.
Well, I mean, I guess I disagree with you on that. Didn't the trial court make an observation that letting the April trial date go would postpone the trial for at least a year?
I don't recall the court saying that it would be for a year, but obviously there's going to be a delay involved.
And Mr. Sacks had already been granted one continuance over the defendant's objection. I mean, why don't those factors, given the deference we give to trial judges in this, why aren't those factors dispositive?
You are correct that there was one continuance before.
And at his request and over the defendant's objection.
And that is a factor to be taken into account. And if those factors can somehow establish that there's some substantive prejudice or some other significant and compelling reason why having the trial in April should reign supreme over the litigant's right to get counsel so he can have his trial in April, then that would be true. I'm saying there's nothing in this record to indicate that the April trial date needed to happen in April, regardless of how long the case had been pending or whatever.
Well,
circumstances have changed.
How's there ever going to be something in a record that meets your test if here we've had a case that's sitting around for 2 years, it's going to take another year to get a new trial date, Mr. Sacks already got one continuance, and it was over the defendant's objection. I mean, what more could you have in a record that would support the trial court's discretion not to continue?
Absolutely. You can have evidence that there's going to be some prejudice. Evidence is going to be spoiled. Witnesses are not going to be available. Other prejudice to a defendant that has to remain around Colorado rather than moving on with his or her life. Those types of things. And those would be legitimate factors for a court to consider in light of the previous continuance and so on. Here, there was absolutely nothing before the court other than we have a trial date, and by golly, I'm going to hold to it.
Okay.
And so I'm saying unless there is some other compelling reason that would prejudice the opposing party, that just simply having the trial date because that's expeditious is not enough to trump the litigant's right to a day in court.
Thank you.
I'll reserve the rest of my time. Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Kay Rice, attorney registration number 9922, and I'm here representing Dr. Orly Ekberg, the appellee, and the doctor who was sued in this case. And I do believe that it's important in balancing rights to also think about her day in court and her right to some resolution of this case. It has been, she was originally sued in 2006. And in response to Mr. Ruffner's statements that we have an uneducated, illiterate man who was essentially pro se, I would point out that Mr. Sack is someone who is very familiar with the court process, litigation process, and has utilized it to a great extent throughout the years. He has been in front of this court in 04 CA 0354 on a probate matter that you may or may not recall. 1 month after his wife died, December 2005, he was suing attorneys John Griebel and Richard Letch. He continued to maintain that litigation going on throughout the course of much of this litigation. According to statements made by Mr. Mahoney, throughout this litigation, while they were preparing for our first trial, which was scheduled for March of 2008, Mr. Sack was in fact consulting with other plaintiffs' attorneys who would then call the Mahoneys and ask them questions about the case. The record reflects that up to 2 weeks before the March 8th trial date, he continued to consult with other plaintiffs' attorneys about this case. It was only 3 days before trial when he, through his counsel, moved to continue, and it was over our strenuous objection trying to advocate for Dr. Ekberg's rights to get resolution through a trial of this case that a new trial date was granted 13 months out. By July of 2008, according to the record, Mr. Sack was notified by the Mahoneys of their intent to withdraw, and he was given names of multiple other attorneys with knowledge and specialty in Med-Mal plaintiff's work. By July, Mr. Mahoney had sent Mr. Sack a letter giving him in writing names of 4 other law firms specializing in this area. August 1, 2008, 9 months before the new trial date, Mr. Sack was notified in writing of the new trial date and told that it was his obligation to either hire other attorneys or prepare to take the case to trial himself. He did hire other attorneys. He had access to other attorneys, but the other attorneys he hired were attorneys to fight the withdrawal. But at the same time, he was threatening to sue the Mahoneys, accusing them of malpractice. And as I think the trial court ultimately pointed out, any reasonable person would realize that it probably isn't going to work out for the Mahoneys to continue representing him if, in fact, he's threatening to sue them and accusing them of incompetence and malpractice.
Rice, is there a difference between refusing to grant a continuance and defaulting someone on a default on a Rule 56?
Yes, Judge, I believe there is. In this case, I don't think that the summary judgment that was ultimately granted is equivalent to a default. I understand case law saying that it is not appropriate to grant a default judgment on summary judgment. In this case, I think it was very different because if you look at the order granting summary judgment, the judge did acknowledge that summary judgment is a drastic remedy and should only be granted when there's a substantive basis to do so. That order was entered by the judge February 18, 2009, and it went into substantively why based on a review of the record, there really wasn't any substantive evidence to support plaintiff's causation theory. So I believe, and it is appropriate to defer to the trial court and overturn rulings about time on an abuse of discretion. The summary judgment order in itself is not on appeal because they have not appealed that. But even if it was, if you look at the order, it was a thoughtful order that didn't just grant it based on default, but rather evaluated the evidence. So really, the issues before this court are the issues of timing. Was he given enough time to respond to the summary judgment motion and essentially to find counsel? Given that he was apparently, there's abundant evidence, talking to other counsel, having them review the case, and trying to convince them to take the case for much of the time period between when he was notified of the Mahoney's intent to withdraw and when the summary judgment was ultimately granted, that the only reasonable inference is that many, many attorneys did look at this case and essentially reached the same conclusion that the trial court reached, which is there's no real evidence here sufficient to even take the case to trial, that looking at the evidence objectively, it doesn't support plaintiff's claim against Dr. Ekberg. The record has a number of statements by the Mahoneys after they moved to withdraw, essentially telling Mr. Sack that same conclusion, that he should give up the case, that the trial court judge apparently also thought this was a matter that would ultimately result in a defense verdict, that attorneys who had looked at this case didn't believe there was any real prospect of recovering anything. There was virtually no chance of a plaintiff's verdict. So the issue here isn't that he didn't have time and opportunity and take advantage of that to consult with many, many attorneys between the withdrawal motion and the ultimate summary judgment, but that there was simply no attorneys who were willing to take the case because there wasn't sufficient evidence to really support the case going forward. And if you look at the economics of this case, the record reflects that by the time the Mahoneys moved to withdraw, they had spent $113,000 in out-of-pocket costs. All the discovery had been done, or virtually all the discovery. The depositions had been taken. The experts had been endorsed. Their depositions had been taken. So as the Mahoneys pointed out, if this was a case that had merit, a plaintiff's attorney would jump at the chance to take it and pursue it if there was a case there. So the fact that he was unable during all that intervening time to find an attorney to take the case really goes to the fact that it wasn't a case with enough merit for an attorney to take it on. It's not the court's burden and it's not our burden to furnish him an attorney for a case without merit. The law makes it clear it is the burden of the person who wants to sue to get counsel. And here where he had litigated the case for years and had access to many attorneys, that's the only conclusion that can be reached. And if you look at the record, throughout this time period, he had attorney after attorney representing him. Several different attorneys from the Underhill law firm represented him in the issues with the Mahoney firm. They looked at the case in depth, and that's reflected by the in-depth briefs they filed. He was represented by Mr. Rutterbury's, Colleen Moriarty, Mr. Ruckner. He met with other attorneys, Frank Cristiano. So by the time it really got to, well, first of all, I would note, and I think Mr. Ruffner concedes this, the hearing November 21, 2008, the trial court ruled verbally, I am granting the motion to withdraw. Mr. Sack was on the phone listening to that. So clearly, at least by November 21, 08, it was absolutely finalized that he was not going to go forward with the Mahoneys. December 11th, he files an objection through his attorney to the proposed order, and his objection states, Mr. Sack has no objection to the publicly filed order that simply notes the motion to withdraw is granted, but then goes on to argue the language of the rest of the order. So he was in the middle of litigation. He just wasn't either he couldn't find an attorney or he wasn't focused on finding an attorney to pursue the lawsuit against Dr. Ekberg. When it got to the summary judgment, the court, in fact, granted him two extensions. The motion for summary judgment was filed January 16th. He moved for a 60-day extension. We opposed it but agreed to a shorter extension, and the court granted him a shorter extension. But then he moved to reconsider, and the court again granted him until February 27th to respond to the motion for summary judgment. The record reflects that Mr. Ruffner actually represented him in a limited extent during that time, so it wasn't that he was completely pro se and had no access to counsel. And it wasn't until March 6, 2009, nearly 2 months later, that the summary judgment was granted. So I think the record is abundant with evidence that he had more than enough time to get counsel and respond. Regarding the continuance of the trial date, the standard regarding whether a continuance should be granted is one of abuse of discretion. Here, where they'd been given one continuance and 13 months between the first continuance and the next trial, to ultimately say no more continuances, you've had more than enough time, is an appropriate ruling. To the standard for a continuance is whether the plaintiff has shown good cause, unforeseen and exceptional circumstances requiring a continuance. I think the trial court appropriately found that that had not been shown, and that plaintiff had had more than enough time to prepare for his trial and to find counsel. I'm going to take any questions and probably rest on the briefs regarding the rest. Thank you very much.
Counsel's argument falls into the same erroneous assumption that the trial court made without any facts or information to support it. And that's that Mr. Sack had enough time to respond to the summary judgment motion. Without any statement, without any findings, without anything to back up that statement.
Well, let me try to recast the issue. It isn't the argument that Mr. Sacks had sufficient time to find another lawyer if he would have started looking in August?
Because if that's the argument, but where's the facts to support that? If he had not fought the withdrawal motion, perhaps, then in essence then he's being faulted for fighting the withdrawal motion, which our rules give him the right to do.
Because didn't he file an affidavit indicating that he was starting to talk to other lawyers about taking over the case in August?
He had indicated that he was talking to other lawyers, but when there's still counsel of record in the case, no attorney is going to spend any time doing that. And that's the problem that he ran into up until the point that the withdrawal was granted. Well, you still have counsel and you're fighting that. What if that withdrawal is denied? Then we've wasted all this time exploring and investigating this case, and we're not even coming into the case. So no attorney is going to take the case at that point. Once you get to the withdrawal, then it's how much time was sufficient for any attorney to come on board, examine it, and be ready for a trial by the next April. And again, there's simply the assumption that there's enough time to respond. That assumption is ignored. The highly complex nature of malpractice cases, and in particular, medical malpractice cases, they are not easy cases. I believe the court takes judicial notice of the Supreme Court statistics on the length of time for cases, types of cases, to proceed through the system. Medical malpractice cases take at the upper end of the length of time it normally takes because they are so complex. There is so much information going on. Counsel argues also that there's no real aspect of recovery, and therefore that's the reason that Mr. Sack could not get an attorney. Pure speculation. There's absolutely nothing in the record to indicate that he could not obtain new counsel because of inability to ultimately recover in the case. Indeed, the only evidence in the record is the affidavit of Frank Cristiano, where he said that the only reason I didn't take the case is because I'm looking at an April trial date, and that's insufficient time to prepare. Any argument to the contrary to that is pure speculation. Pure speculation on behalf of the trial court and speculation by counsel. There's this aura that's underpinning the arguments in this case, and that maybe even of the court below. And it comes from the comment, a plaintiff's attorney would jump at the chance to take a case. I don't know where that comes from. Medical malpractice cases are some of the most difficult to get attorneys in because they are so complex. They require such an investment of time and money. They are very, very, very carefully reviewed before they're taken on. Attorneys aren't out there jumping at the chance to take on a medical malpractice case, nor should they be. They should have time to thoroughly investigate these matters. And that thorough investigation time, and indeed even thorough preparation time, simply was what was denied to Mr. Sack. Try as he might, he simply could not get that additional time to have the Frank Cristianos or other attorneys come in and take the case without having to have the trial happen 2 to 3 months after they took it.
Mr. Ruffner?
Yes.
You haven't appealed the withdrawal. The order on the motion to withdraw. You have not appealed that, is my understanding.
So,
isn't that a concession that there were grounds to withdraw, that the court did not abuse its discretion in granting that withdrawal?
I'm not disagreeing with the court on the withdrawal.
All right, so don't we go back to, shouldn't your client have known it was possible, indeed likely, that the withdrawal would happen once that letter was sent in late August?
I certainly agree with the court that it was possible.
Well,
I agree with the court that it was likely to.
You tell your attorney, you've committed malpractice and I'm going to sue you.
Right.
I mean, at that point, as a client, how can you reasonably expect the relationship to continue?
If he had dropped the objection to the withdrawal, then that is true. But he did not withdraw that. That was part of an overall letter of his counsel at the time, who came in just for that very limited purpose, to try to convince the attorneys to stay on the case. Again, I'm just simply trying to get in the minds of the attorney who wrote the letter. And that's the attorney, not Mr. Sack, although I realize it's his agent. But nevertheless, that was the attempt to simply get the attorneys to stay on board, because we do have an April trial date coming down. You're putting me in an impossible situation here.
Well, it just doesn't read to me like a letter that's truly intended to convince counsel to stay on the case.
I don't disagree with that assessment. I'm not happy with the letter myself, but it is what it is. The point is that once the contest is there and there's going to be a hearing scheduled, either the objection to the withdrawal is going to happen or they're going to go ahead with the hearing to determine whether the withdrawal should happen. And that's exactly what happened. So I'm not disputing that you're going to look at the time as one factor of whether the discretion was exercised appropriately by looking at that time from November 21st. But I do dispute whether it should go all the way back to August, given the fact that at least Mr. Sack was objecting to the withdrawal of counsel and did not want them to withdraw. Thank you, Your Honor. Appreciate it.
We appreciate the arguments of both counsel. The case stands submitted. A written opinion will issue in due course. I remind you of Friday if you want to file anything on the confidentiality issue. Otherwise, counsel are excused, and counsel in our second case can set up as soon as the tables are cleared.
Thank you.